Nathan's mother is thinking about the body of Christ and the wings of angels. Her spirit lightens in the safety, the sanctity of the church. Dark hair surrounds her pretty oval face. Light from the stained glass window tints her skin. Nathan thinks about the body of the son of the farmer who owns the house Nathan's parents rented 3 weeks ago. Jesus has a face like that boy, a serene smile with dimples, a nose that's a little too big, and Jesus has the same strong, smooth arms.
Writer Jim Grimsley. He'll be back in just a moment with more about his new novel, Dream Boy, and with comments about his first book, Winter Birds. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. To theatergoers in New York, Seattle, and Atlanta, Jim Grimsley is probably best known as the award-winning playwright-in-residence at Atlanta's Seven Stages Theater. But thanks to the recent publication of two novels, Winter Birds and Dream Boy, Grimsley's work is now reaching new audiences. Both books are set in the modern South. Both are fictional portraits of youngsters, Danny, Nathan, and Roy, endangered by the very people who should protect them most. Winter Birds and Dream Boy also explore adolescent love, gay sexuality, religion, and personal identity. Novelist Dorothy Allison found Winter Birds so moving that, in her words, I wanted to steal it and pretend it was mine. Poet Fred Chappell says that Dream Boy will appeal to readers who admire difficult, even harrowing materials made into beautiful design. With an excerpt from his new novel, Dream Boy, here is Jim Grimsley.
This passage takes place at Nathan's dinner table with his mother and father early in the book. Their guest for supper is St. Paul, and the text is Romans chapter 1. Dad reads neither aloud nor silently. He chants softly as if he is alone, the words a stream of sound that barely rises above the gold-edged pages of God's holy word. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. The whiskey sits at his right hand, the knife and fork at the left. Today it is real whiskey bought from the local package store, not the clear moonshine of weekends and holidays. Mom, restless, gives the appearance of hovering slightly above the seat of her chair. Neither listening nor speaking, she chews her food in a mechanical motion. As always at mealtime, she wears a frightened expression, glancing from Dad to Nathan, then fixing her attention on her plate. Dad reads, "Professing themselves wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man and to birds and to four-footed beasts and creeping things." Nathan eats, though he can hardly taste. When he sits at the supper table with Mom and Dad, the twisting of his gut is unrelenting, and every soft spoken word from the King James Bible reverberates. They are a family during certain mealtimes and during church. Each night, each Sunday, they eat together because they always have. The repetition echoes darkly through the country of Nathan's memory, through all the dangerous territories in which his thought may no longer move freely, through all that he has forgotten and locked away.
Jim, let's begin with this. Your fiction is powerful. It is imaginative. You have a wonderful sense of language, a marvelous ear. Aesthetically, I suppose you're getting nothing but praise. But gosh, these books are depressing. They are negative? How about this?
That's much too negative a word, I think. I think the books are about very hard subjects. I hope that in the future I'll be able to move to something a little more comic. But yeah, this first couple of books is about children who are endangered by their own families. Uh-huh. And I think since that's been so much of a theme in my life, and it seems to be so much of a theme in the modern world, I think it's an important thing to talk about, even if it is a little hard on the reader every now and then.
It certainly is. It is rewarding. It is rewarding. But these, as you say, are difficult books.
Yes.
Jim Grimsley, tell our listeners what happens in Dream Boy.
A boy named Nathan and his family move into a house next door to another boy whose name is Roy, and a very deep, intense friendship develops between Roy and Nathan at the same time that Roy is learning about Nathan and his family. What Roy learns is that Nathan is being mistreated by his father.
Mm-hmm. Now, wait, let's pause on that word. Mistreated translates to what? Sexually abused.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Has been sexually abused by his father, and but none of this is explicit. None of it is actually subject of conversations between Roy and Nathan. It's just something that Roy is left to learn about Nathan.
Uh-huh.
In the meantime, in order to protect Nathan, Roy more or less takes him out of his house, and one of his solutions is to take him on a camping trip from which neither of them is going to come back.
Do you want to tell our listeners what happens on this camping trip? I will leave that to you.
Well, part of what happens on the camping trip, I'll tell them, which is that they get into a haunted house.
Uh-huh.
They have a haunted house adventure.
They certainly do.
In the woods.
This book is full of ghosts.
Yes, very, very much. And the dead are always present,
uh-huh,
even at the end. So I think that's about as much as I'd want to give away about the end.
All right. What about the theme of religion? This is something, I suppose, that powerfully informs not only the book but your imagination.
Yeah.
Again, without letting the cat out of the bag, we have, as it were, a sort of resurrection theme going on at the end of the book. Talk to us about that.
The church played a really important part in my life. It provides virtually the only culture that you're going to get in a rural environment. It's a place where people gather for social reasons and for spiritual reasons. So it had a very profound shaping influence on me, and I think I've tried to carry that over in this second book in particular.
Uh-huh.
The church is not particularly important to Winter Birds, my first novel, but for Dream Boy, it is the backdrop against which all of the rest of the action is played. Roy and Nathan learn about the way boys are supposed to behave partly through their church, and the other part of that behavior they learn at school.
Mm-hmm.
So when they begin to behave in ways that boys don't customarily behave in the South or aren't supposed to behave in the South, when they begin having sex with each other, then the church becomes a kind of invisible censor sitting over Roy's shoulder telling him you can't do this openly and you need to warn Nathan that he's to keep this secret, that,
uh-huh,
you know, I'm doing this, but I don't need to. I have a girlfriend. These are things that Roy tells Nathan.
Now, the theme of sexuality is intimately connected in your fiction with themes of guilt,
mm-hmm,
and remorse and penance
and
violence, being good on the surface, being, mm-hmm, spiritually vexatious. These are very spiritual books in the sense that you are trying,
yeah,
to figure out spiritual behavior.
Yeah.
How do you come to these questions as a novelist?
I come to them with the certainty that they're the most important questions, at least in my life. I think spirituality and sexuality are very, very much tied together in my own mind, but they're not necessarily tied together in the way that you learn about them.
Mm.
I mean, what the church in particular teaches you in the South is that sexuality is a thing that's to be tamped down and contained and controlled. It's not a natural side of people that you want to emphasize or to explore to any great degree. The question of the connection between sexuality and violence, I think, comes out of that same, I don't know what to call it, trend or way of thinking that we go through down here. If you tamp down sexuality, if you deny it, if you try to contain it, it's going to come out in some other place, and possibly in a place where it's not controlled.
Would you call yourself, Jim Grimsley, a writer of fiction about sexuality and gender? Do you think of yourself as a gay writer? I mean, you have very explicit gay themes in your fiction.
Yeah.
This is a tough problem because you want to assert yourself as a writer, but you don't want to be labeled, I take it.
Right.
How about this?
Well, actually, I don't mind the label as long as it's used simply as a label. You know, I don't mind being thought of as a writer who writes about sexuality or about gay sexuality. I'm clearly a gay writer.
Uh-huh. You know? After all, how many people write books with sex in them and they aren't necessarily known as sexual writers?
Right.
Uh-huh.
That's what I'm thinking, is that if if somebody's trying to call me a gay writer in a way that's a limiting, you know, I'm as serious a writer as there is mm-hmm. of any kind, mm-hmm. you know, straight, gay, twisted, whatever you want to call
right.
it. But certainly gay writer is a descriptive term when it's used, especially about a book like Dream Boy.
Are you a defender of what, the gay lifestyle, of homosexuality, in the sense that this is what drives your fiction?
Mm-hmm.
How about that?
No, I don't think that my sexual lifestyle drives my writing. What drives my writing is the will to write. The fact that gay sex comes into my books is simply... I mean, gay sex comes into the world whether people want to deal with that or not.
Right.
So, to my mind, no writer is really complete, to me, until they've shown me what they would do dealing with same-sex relationships in their books. I mean, I think it's incumbent on heterosexual writers to include gay characters in their books. They're in the world,
mm-hmm.
you know. The more information that gets out on that subject, the better off we're all going to be. Then we'll simply become sexual beings.
Well, momentarily, Jim Grimsley, we could revisit your first book, which is Winter Birds. You have a kind of character in this book that you call the River Man.
Right.
Who, I suppose, if you move backward and forward fictionally in time, you have the beginnings here of how a young boy shapes his sense of his own sexual identity, mm-hmm. his paternal, the relationship with his father. Right. Am I on the right track here?
Yes, you are. I think what I tried to do in Dream Boy was to take that process further and deal with not just the sexuality of the boy who is in danger,
mm-hmm.
Nathan in the case of Dream Boy and Danny in the case of Winter Birds, but also then to deal with some of the ways that other males in the vicinity of these two boys, the way those males use their sexuality. I mean, the father is a very dangerous type because his sexuality is focused on his son, and in a very surreptitious way, a way that he can't quite resolve to his obligations as a parent.
Mm-hmm.
Roy's sexuality is twisted in another direction. He knows that he's supposed to be a straight boy. He's supposed to date girls. And he is not supposed to be messing around with other boys in a sexual way. Well, he can fulfill the first two of those functions, but as he grows older, he becomes increasingly sexual with men. I think probably if there's a gay character in the book, it's more nearly Roy and not necessarily Nathan.
Nathan is still struggling to figure out who he is and what he is, as not only sexually, but as a person.
Yeah.
He is shaping himself.
Nathan's in so much danger that he really doesn't get to make choices.
Uh-huh.
And I think that Roy, it represents as much protection as he does anything else in Nathan's life.
Jim, tell us about your literary models.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking, for example, names like William Faulkner and Ambrose Bierce, who may not necessarily be a sort of Southern writer.
Mm-hmm.
Faulkner certainly was. Those two came to mind. Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a sort of, in the best sense, horrific element in your fiction. How about this?
I think those are good models. Those are certainly people that I've read and admired. I also would reach, you know, southward to South American writers like Alejo Carpentier, who's a Cuban writer,
mm-hmm.
Garcia Marquez. Of course, everybody would name Garcia Marquez at this point. But
oh, well, now wait. This book, Dream Boy, is full of magical realism.
Right.
The end of it is certainly, what shall we call it, a dream sequence in which we're not really sure who's alive and who's dead.
Right. Well, I'm sure who I think is alive and dead. I think they're all alive, but I certainly couldn't defend that as a definitive reading of the end of the book.
Right.
I mean, it's clear that at the end of this book, I'm trying to stretch the limit of realism to say that this is a real event if you look at it in a particular way.
Right.
I think the term magic realism applies very well to this book. It sets its own rules.
To come back to Faulkner for a moment and to combine our earlier discussion about sexual themes and identity themes,
mm-hmm.
Could I accuse you of hating the South?
No.
I mean, after all, you
could accuse me of it, yes.
Well, how would you respond to it? My what I'm getting at is this. You have adult males in these books who are grotesques.
Yes.
Who are sexual predators, I could say to you, you are indicting that very idea of Southern manhood that Southern men take so much pride in and which they have perverted. How about this?
I think that's entirely a fair reading of these two books. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is, I certainly couldn't defend myself as a person who believes that there are good fathers on the basis of what I've written so far.
Right.
Now, of course, when viewed in the context of the plays that I've written and the books that I've gone on to write since these two, I think I'm beginning to come to a more mature reading of the South as a social structure. What I was concerned with in these first two books was to tell a very specific story about boys, basically, who are in a great deal of danger from the adults who should be caring for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that leads me to the similarities in these two books, the fact that there is family violence in both books. In the case of Winterbird's, very severe family violence that's generalized over a family. And in the case of Dream Boy, a very specific kind of violence that flows from the father to the son.
Now, you novelists are always accused of speaking to the public, to your readers on many levels at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Should I accuse you, Jim Grimsley, of sort of making fun of this whole idea of family values and what it means to belong to a family? Because on the one side, your families in these books appear to be normal.
Right.
They exude that sense of, well, we're just part of the community. And yet you go beneath the surface and you have these violent, distressing circumstances. How about this?
Well, my answer to that would be sort of twofold. The first part would be a kind of a glib answer, which is, yes, these are the family values that I grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, intact families are very, very often crippled. They don't function well. I mean, my father was present throughout all of my childhood, but he was not a benevolent influence on my childhood.
Are you looking for a dad? Are you looking
No.
for a father? Is that too facile to psychologize this fiction?
Yeah. I am exploring the varieties of bad fathers in these books, and I think that's very different from looking for a father. You know, I'm too old to need a father now. It would have been nice to have one, a good one, when I was growing up.
Uh-huh.
But I never thought of myself as fatherless. He was right there. He was a very powerful influence on my life. I never thought of him in terms of his being a good father or a bad father. We were so far inside our circumstances that we didn't really think that way. He was just a father. He did what fathers did. His behavior wasn't altogether very different from what some of our neighbors went through, certainly not all of them.
Mm-hmm. What about the women in your books, Jim? You have, for example, Nathan's mother is, she's loving, she's affectionate, she wants to protect her little boy,
mm-hmm.
and yet she cowers and quavers there on the edge of these scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Again, in Winter Birds, in your first novel, you have a mother who is protective of, what is it, five or six kids?
Five children
in this instance. And yet essentially is helpless in facing this terrible, violent father figure who takes out his wrath on her and on the children.
Right. I think they're very different characters, actually. The mother in Winterbirds is a very strong woman who is, it's true that she's not able to stop her husband from drinking, to stop him from being a violent man.
But she is determined.
But she protects her children from him,
uh-huh.
and she does so very powerfully. That's a woman of strength. I think the portrait in Nathan's mother, what you're seeing is a woman who can't face the truth. She wants to put up a facade of protecting and loving her son.
Right.
But when it comes to the actual reality of what her husband's doing to her own child that she knows about,
mm-hmm.
she wants to kind of make nice. She wants to go to church with him and be a family in public ways and not to deal with the fact that her husband does horrible things to her child and that she knows this.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, you have a mother who's in denial. Danny's mother in Winterbirds is not in denial. She knows what's happening to her. That's the only way she can survive, by her own honesty, by knowing that in order to endure her life, she has to endure the violence of her life.
Jim, how would you characterize your responsibility as a writer when you handle these very serious themes, sexuality, gender, identity, family violence, abuse? Again, these books are a pleasure to read because you are a powerful writer, but they are very serious, very grim themes. Yeah. Now, you're taking them out there into the wide world. What is your responsibility?
My responsibility is to own it, to especially when I was dealing with this in terms of Winter Birds, which was the first of these books to come out, what I realized was that it was necessary for me to admit that that book comes out of my life, that it's a book that's based on my own biography. Because what I'm dealing with is a family where the father beats the wife regularly and the father basically controls their lives to an inordinate degree. What I wanted very much was for people to know that I was writing that story from a place of authority, so that when the book reached people to whom these kinds of events had also happened, they would understand that I did know what I was talking about and did live through circumstances very much like these. With Dream Boy, what I'm trying to write about is, in a way, an even grimmer kind of story where the boy has no protection at all. I mean, Danny is protected by his mother, and he can rely on that. Nathan is not protected by anyone and is on the path to his own death from the beginning of the book. My responsibility in the case of Nathan is to face the material that I've written without flinching, and yet not to say anything that I think is going to cheapen it at the same time. I mean, I don't think Dream Boy is a good book for a kind of psychological evaluation of an abused child. That's not what I'm trying to talk about there. I'm really trying to talk about the transformation of a spiritually pure boy into a person who can actually make connections with other people.
Jim, talk to us about, shall we call it the dream theme? That is to say, dreams and illusion and reality. This is something that runs through both books in a way. How about it?
Right. It runs through most of my work. I've spoken before about my need, what I feel is my need to write from the place where people dream, not to write from a literal, conscious reality. Reality is very much a construct. It's very much something that the human brain makes out of what it sees in the world. Mm-hmm. When I write, I try to reach below the layer of people's consciousness to the place where dream images tend to come up, so that what you have is a sense that, what I want you to have when you read a book of mine is a sense that you're on a journey that is dreamlike, that may not be what I see in the literal everyday world, but that makes sense still in. And I think that's very important when you're trying to get people to deal with subjects that are not pleasant when they're approached in everyday reality.
Mm-hmm. How do you think of this in artistic terms? It gets to be very slippery, I would suppose, right. The kind of imagery, metaphorical work that you have to do in presenting these plots in dreamlike terms.
It takes a lot of patience, and it requires for me to be fairly ignorant of what's coming on the next page of what I write. I mean, I do not work from outlines. I never have. I don't know how a book is going to end when I begin it.
So you're just as eager to find out as the reader.
And I have to put myself in a position where the choice I make comes up out of a feeling more so than a thought, if that makes any sense. In Dream Boy, for instance, the choice to take the book into the camping trip and the haunted house was not something that I knew when I was writing page one of that book. It was something that came up out of the circumstances. And in fact, when I got to that part of the book, it took me a long time to understand exactly what was going to happen. I had the image of the plantation, the lost plantation in the woods, but I didn't know what was going to happen there. So that as I wrote toward it, I began to feel what was going to happen, that it was very dangerous and it was very dark and powerful, but I didn't know the literal event, and I certainly didn't know what was going to come after that in terms of what happens to Nathan, the transformation that he undergoes in the book.
Jim Grimsley is the author of Dream Boy, a new novel available from Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. His first book, Winter Birds, was a Penn Hemingway Award finalist and won the Sue Kaufman Prize for First Fiction from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Jim Grimsley is playwright-in-residence at Seven Stages Theater in Atlanta. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. With another reading now from Dream Boy, here again is Jim Grimsley.
What's going on in this passage is that the two boys are going for a walk in the woods. Roy is one of the boys. He knows where there's an Indian mound in the forest, and he wants to show it to his friend Nathan. The passage takes place on the Indian mound. Their two fleshes are bright together, the two boys, warm like the colors of the late sky. The sun still has some descending to do, and they watch it and the clouds for a while. Roy settles along the ground, spreading out his shirt, and Nathan does the same. Soon they are layered against each other. Roy says the movement of the treetops is like the ocean. Nathan knows nothing about the ocean. He listens to the murmuring of Roy's insides, the ferocious heartbeat that shakes through them both. Roy is murmuring in Nathan's ear a hymn from church. There is a place of quiet rest near to the heart of God. Nathan sings too, kissing Roy's soft throat, his collarbones, the underside of his chin. He can smell Roy's body. He can taste it with the tip of his tongue. Roy grips the back of Nathan's head as if afraid he will escape. He need not worry. Nathan knows the nakedness Roy wants and soon achieves it. Roy arches with his body toward Nathan, a curve of yearning. He lies bare in the grass with a look on his face as if Nathan is making him sing through every cell. They lie still while the sun settles into the green bath of leaves. Roy says nothing, but Nathan can feel how his spirit darkens. The banded sky begins to drain of color as they dress. Roy stands with his hands in his pockets. He calls Nathan in a strangled voice, and Nathan walks close. He brings Nathan's ear to his mouth and says, "Please don't say anything about this to anybody. Please."
It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was writer Jim Grimsley. Cassette tapes of this program are available for $10 postpaid. Please write to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 788. That's program number 788. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Next week on Soundings, the literature of women's lives. Join me for a conversation with Phyllis Rose of Wesleyan University. Phyllis Rose is the editor of the Norton Book of Women's Lives. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. New fiction from novelist Jim Grimsley, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for readings and conversation about two of Jim Grimsley's books, Winter Birds and Dream Boy. Jim Grimsley writes about family, sexuality, identity, and youngsters in danger. The New Yorker magazine praises his portraits of the Southern landscape viewed from a gay perspective, with the bitterness of memory, but also with unwavering, unsentimental love. Winter Birds and Dream Boy, new fiction from novelist and playwright Jim Grimsley, this week on Soundings.